This episode is brought to you by IVP. Many churches are struggling to connect with their communities and are facing a decline. But God is inviting His church to be reborn from the inside out. In his book, Remissioning Church, Pastor Joshua Hayden brings inspiring vision, practical tools, and field-tested methods to offer church leaders solutions for resurrecting their congregations, while also focusing on serving their neighbors and the world. This guide will help you answer God's call and lead your congregation into a future filled with purpose and mission. Stay tuned until the end of the episode to find out how you can get 25% off Remissioning Church at ivypress.com.
This is IVP.
There has to be a space, I think, for us to be able to do the thing we're gifted to do and feel God's pleasure in it. And I think it's about us seeking the praise that comes from God and tapping into the joy of what He has created us to do and not the praise of people.
Welcome to The Disruptors, a podcast from InterVarsity Press. I'm your host, Nicole Massey-Martin. In this season of The Disruptors, we're talking about disruptive leadership, specifically about how we can inspire one another to crucify our leadership idols and nail our outdated leadership practices to the cross. In this episode, I'm sitting down with the lead pastor of Hillsong East Coast, Krishan Jayaratnam, to talk about crucifying ego. Krishan and I discuss the challenges that celebrity-driven culture poses to modern Christianity. We talk about the societal pressures that can lead to narcissism and why it's so important for pastors and other leaders to maintain genuine connections with people to foster humility and joy in their leadership. Krishan also talks about how his own daily practices of stillness and reflection offer him resilience against the dangers of an unchecked ego. This is going to be a fascinating conversation. Let's get started. Welcome, Krishan.
Thank you, Nicole. Such a joy to be with you. Thank you for including me in this conversation.
Well, I knew the moment that we met that I wanted to have a deeper dialogue with you because the way that you show up is just a breath of fresh air when you think about what pastoral leadership looks like today. You are the pastor of Hillsong New York, and you've been with Hillsong for 20 years, I believe, or is it
40 years?
40 years.
40 years this year. So that's, it's a pretty cool milestone.
That you must have been like in the church as a baby.
I was in the church when I was very young. I was 7 when we first started coming to our church.
Oh my goodness. And you've been married for 18 years this year. Congratulations. And you have 4 girls. God bless your heart and soul.
They are a gift. Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's dive right in because today's topic is on crucifying ego. And when I wrote this chapter, I wasn't thinking that ego was such a significant issue. I knew it was a significant issue for leadership. I knew that it was something that Christians ought to be wrestling with. I had no idea how ego would take over so much of our lives, of our understanding of life and politics and preference and family and relationships. So I'm eager to hear just a little bit of your story and how you began to shape your understanding of self. So start wherever you want and just tell us, who is Krishan and how did you come to know who you are?
Wow, what a question.
Yeah.
I think some of those things I'm still figuring out. 46 years old, I'm still figuring out some of who I am and how I'm wired. And the more I get exposed to different ways of thinking and different traditions in the broader church, the more I discover about myself. And so these last few years has been a joy for me in that regard, like being able to engage with some different thinking and some broad traditions. And I've been learning a lot. But look, I mean, I grew up as a son of 2 Sri Lankan parents growing up in Australia. And you've got the way that you learn to blend in when you're at school, because you quickly learn if I pronounce things this way or that way, that I'm going to be teased for that. So you're learning like through a bunch of subconscious cues, this is how I need to turn up at school. And then at home, I'm turning up differently because I'm trying to connect. And so I think, you know, maybe right from the start of the earliest times I can remember, I'm looking to try and connect and I'm looking to try and fit in everywhere I go. I'm changing my accent without knowing to speak to my older family. And I'm changing it again when I'm speaking to my friends at school. My kids found an old video of me speaking when I was maybe in my early 20s.
Yeah.
And I was like so shocked. I sounded so Australian. I probably still sound really Australian.
Yes, too American, do.
All these years later and living in New York for a number of years now, some of that starts to shift as well. And so some of that's this desire to want to be able to connect, to want to be able to have people understand me and see me. And so some of that forms the background of my story. And then opportunities that we've had these last few years to just, I think, delve deeper when it comes into contemplative traditions in Christian faith and what it looks like to engage with God in silence as well as in celebration. And so some of those things I think have been great for helping me understand what I'm like, who I am. Yeah, I believe in the power of God to work at work today. I believe I'll probably have a quite mystic way of thinking about how we can engage with God and his presence and his reality. And at the same time, I'm a big believer and lover of the church and church community and how God's established all of that. So, but more than anything, I mean, for me, like being with my family, spending time with my kids, being in creation and nature with people that I really love, that's that brings me life and joy. And so
That's
it. Was a big question. That was a scattergun answer. Yeah. And I am
that's great.
You know, I'm sorry, take what you want.
No, that was so helpful, because sometimes I found that people who have had to, I've heard the phrase code switch, you know, people who have had to kind of wear different hats in different scenarios often take longer to figure out who they really are, because they recognize that sometimes who they are, as you described, like having a certain way of connecting with your older family members, means that sometimes I can feel like a different person to the one who's trying to connect with people at school. But it's not a different person. It's just, it sounds like at an early age, you learned how to show up in a way that helped people to really see you and helped people to feel at ease in your presence.
I hope that's what it is. You know, I think some of it is that desire to want to fit in. I don't think all of it's as altruistic as that. And especially at an early age, you're just trying to be accepted and be one of the guys, and you know, you have all the different thoughts that go with that. So I think at its earliest iteration, it's survival and it's really basic. And hopefully as it's matured, it's become something more like what you were describing.
Yes.
And, you know, wanting to help reach people.
Yes. Well, I mean, part of that had to flow into your sense of calling, because I see how being able to wear different hats and switch codes is especially effective in pastoral leadership. But tell us about your moment of knowing, I am called to pastor.
Wow. Okay, so for me, there probably wasn't one moment. I grew up wanting to do law. I ended up studying science, information systems. And during that period is when I really got involved in church. So I'd been at our church since I was young, but in terms of being involved in leadership and serving others that were my peers, that was that period of time where I'm at college. And so during that, I think I start to notice a number of things. Like, I think in service and in community, I start to notice gifts that are on my life. Mm. And that's when I start to really wrestle with, well, is this maybe how I'm meant to use these gifts? And as they came to the surface, I think, you know, it's probably a period of a year or two that were really critical for me in those college years in wrestling with these gifts that I was noticing and thinking about how God might have me use them. And I'd always been really, I'd never even entertained the idea of being in ministry. It wasn't even something I'd seriously ever considered. And then as I got more involved in church life and volunteering, it started to become something that I felt a tug in my heart towards. And that bore out in, you know, kind of the feedback and the testimony of others and leaders that I trusted and loved. My dad in his initial stage was maybe not as affirming of that idea or that jump, but it was over a course of time and making some key understandings about how I was wired then and some gifts that were on my life. But all of it came about in community and in serving as a part of a community where all of those things started to light up for me.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, you know, when we think about what ego looks like in the pastorate, I confess to you that my lens is I really believe we are in the era of celebrity pastors. I mean, in the earliest stages, you could say this was like televangelism, where pastors were just for the first time seen on television. But now with social media, with YouTube, with all kinds of resources at our fingertips, you can easily make the shift between, you know, from I feel called, my community affirms my gifts, to this is actually about me. This is about my brand, about my platform, about my desire to be seen. Have you ever felt that tension in ministry?
I think so. Maybe not as brutally as you put it, but definitely that sense of like, I mean, when you're stepping into ministry, and if it's pastoral and part of that role is going to be preaching or sharing the word, like that's a huge level of trust. That's something to be really stewarded well. And I think anyone involved in that, there is a sense of you're going to be on a platform and people are going to look at you and you are going to deliver something. In the environment that I grew up in, that meant that everyone was going to be really kind and really affirming. You had to really seek out kind of the feedback that was going to really help you grow and develop and challenge what you were doing. But largely, overwhelmingly, super positive, everyone's super kind. So you end up doing these things that get really rewarded in terms of your interpersonal connections. And so I think that part of it's always been there. I think you layer on what you're talking about in terms of maybe the different platforms that can be used, and that probably dials up that reality.
It's definitely certain contexts that make it more difficult. So my dad was a pastor, and I have, outside of my dad's churches, I've been involved in very large churches for probably 20 plus years. And there is something that happens when you step onto a stage and you're looking out at thousands of people who sometimes stand up and clap when they hear what you have said. And I have seen the addictive nature of that kind of setting. But I've also found you have to work hard to fight the egotistical part of you that sees and hears that applause, that sees the pat on the back and, you know, oh, pastor, oh, reverend, oh, you changed my life. Oh, man, your words just lifted me from the grave. Like, what? I mean, and maybe the question is like, what does that framework look like for people who do get a little rise from that type of applause? How do we tame the ego in a society where people applaud the person and they want your brand and they want your platform? And they're like, oh, Pastor Krishan, you're the one who changed my life. How are you supposed to keep your ego in check? And what do you do? Because I know you have your ego in check. What are you doing to prevent you from saying, this is, yes, I am your God?
I hope I have my ego in check.
Yeah, it's a daily process
that you constantly keep in check. I genuinely think there's a tension there, because if you are created and wired and gifted to communicate or to preach and you're called to do that, then sometimes I think we go so heavy on we've got to discipline that and we've got to bring it in check, which we do. And I think that's really important. I'm looking forward to talking about that. The tension I think we need to lay a hold of is if you are created for that, it's like Eric Liddell. He's like, when I run, I feel God's pleasure. So there has to be a space, I think, for us to be able to do the thing we're gifted to do and feel God's pleasure in it. And I think it's about us seeking the praise that comes from God and tapping into the joy of what He has created us to do, and not the praise of people. But there is a place to enjoy what you're doing. I hope that when I get on the platform to my last sermon ever, that there'll be an aspect of finding God's pleasure in that and allowing that to affect my affect, to affect my myself bodily, for myself to be able to sit in the joy of God's pleasure in what's happening. And so I think that side of it's important as well. And then, yes, absolutely, like bringing the ego into check and disciplining it. I think we need to give ourselves to possibly even some practices that keep us grounded in humility. There was an article that Jerry Usim wrote in The Atlantic many years ago now, but the headline of it was, which I've never forgotten, the headline of it was Power Causes Brain Damage. And he was basically highlighting some of the research that says the more you're in an environment where people keep telling you you're fantastic and keep executing everything that you want, the more it affects your brain's ability to mirror what's going on in somebody else, to empathize. And so the longer you stay in positions of power like that, there is a diminishing of some of the skills that brought you into that place in the first place, your ability to read the room and respond with compassion. And so I think that it's no coincidence that Jesus is over and over and over again with his team, he's challenging them and saying, you guys aren't getting this. Like, if you want to be great, you got to be the servant of all. I think that that kind of driving force behind Jesus's communication to his disciples, I think is to help keep us grounded, because God knows what happens to us in the absence of that, and it affects our humanity. So Jesus is about to go to the cross, and he gives us, we have this beautiful Lord's Supper that he initiates, but then the other physical thing that he's doing is he's going and washing his disciples' feet. And I think it's easy for us to kind of think, well, maybe that's an exception to what it means to be God.
Yeah.
Maybe that's part of how Jesus coming to earth and humbling himself. But I don't think it is. I think it's what it's Jesus showing us what it means to be God. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we find in Philippians chapter 2 again. Like Jesus is showing us this is what it means to be God. And why that's important is because he is the image of the invisible God. So through him, we come to understand in flesh and blood what we cannot maybe grasp outside of it. And so if he's the image of the invisible, then he is showing us what it means to be God. So as he is on his knees washing his disciples' feet, he's showing us this is what God is like. And if we're created in God's image, then our humanity is wrapped up in our ability to engage with humility. And so as we give ourselves to that, we're becoming more human. In that sense, our humanity flourishes. So I think when we think about this idea of like, we've got to tame the ego, it can be about the discipline of it. And it can be about, these are all the things you got to cut out. And this is how you got to make it really hard for yourself. And it is hard. It's going to be hard. And there's no getting around that. But its effect is to cause our humanity to flourish. And so I think we got to lay hold of the joy of that as well.
Oh, I love the way, okay, so there's like 15 things you said that were just, see, now look at me putting you on a platform. Oh, Pastor Krishan, you just touched my life. But I mean, I'm listening to you and I'm hearing the importance of holding intention, the discipline of the ego, like keep it in check, with the delight that God has given us when we do what he's called us to do. And I'm so glad you named that, because I think we do a disservice to the people that we serve and the teams that we lead when we tell everybody, no egos. I mean, I once worked for a boss who said, no logos, no egos. And we would be like, but how will people know who we are? Like, how will they buy our products if there's no logo on it? And then on the opposite side of things, then you've got this like, it's all you and it's all everybody out there. You have to be the one name that they remember, and you have to. So if you only have one message, then you're doing a disservice to the people who need their ego built up, and you're doing a disservice to the people who need their ego brought down. So I love that tension. If it's so clear in scripture, and I believe it is, then why do so many Christian leaders struggle with this?
From my experience, I think that part of the challenge is, as a leader, staying grounded, staying differentiated, and flourishing in your soul. And I think the environment that we're in is broadly one of anxiousness and a sense of trauma in people. Whether people have experienced something that we would traditionally call trauma or not, there is certainly in the broader culture a sense of trauma that's being, we're bearing witness to it in our bodies. And so I think when you then step in as a leader into an environment where you've got all of these things going on, what it looks like to stay grounded, to sit within your window of tolerance, becomes something really difficult to do. And when we get out of that window and we start to lead out of that window, we don't show up as our full selves. We react to things out of our past. And sometimes it's not Krishan, the 46-year-old leader and pastor who understands things and has read things and knows the word and loves the Lord who rocks up. It's sometimes like 8-year-old Krishan who rocks up because something has activated something in me, and now I'm, you know. So I think in this season, like, what it means for leaders to stay grounded and be able to sit within that window becomes really, really important. Elizabeth Stanley has this book called Widen the Window, and she talks about the window of tolerance. Basically describes when, you know, when you come out of that window of tolerance, you can either come out of it into like a hyper arousal, or you can come out of it into a hypo arousal. So either getting really active, doing more and more and more, or kind of no emotions, I don't feel anything. And I think I've experienced both of those. And I think sometimes as leaders, our default can be towards activity. And so we're constantly pressing into more activity and ignoring the stuff that's going on in the soul. And so you just keep giving yourself to activity, but it's not always coming from a healthy place. And lots of constant activity is its own kind of trauma response. And so I think without pausing to address the soul and without the stillness that takes and understanding some of those practices, I think we can just kind of keep going and going and going. You never take the time to reflect, which is part of the growth. And you get activated into a state where everything feels like it's coming at you. And so even the people that are coming at you to try and help you and point out the thing that you know already, which is that you're not perfect.
Yeah.
And yet you can end up in these states where everything feels like it's coming as an attack. And so you get defensive as a leader. So I think there's a lot of things that play into it. But I think certainly the kind of broader culture that we're in at the moment, to be a leader, and particularly a leader in a church environment, I think it can be really tough. And so, you know, I come from a tradition where maybe we haven't had the richness of some of the church traditions and the thinking around all of that. So it's a lot for us to learn and grow in and develop. Yeah.
When you said that, you know, our busyness as leaders is sometimes a trauma response in and of itself. And then when you add to that, if we're coming from backgrounds, whether that's a church background or a business background, that's not rooted in a practice of pausing, then we don't have any time for reflection. And I'm wondering, you know, this overused phrase or this overused term, narcissism, I wonder if narcissism is in and of itself a trauma response in some ways. If narcissism is, for some people, a coping strategy, or if it's just our society is built to foster and reward narcissism in a way that says you don't have to pause and overcorrect or change because you're going to get more money, you're going to get more fame, you're going to get more platform if you keep doing things that biblically ruin the soul. I'm wondering, I mean, what are your thoughts around that and this idea of narcissism that some sociologists are saying is more present in our society across generations now than it's ever been before?
Right. Look, I think that would take someone wiser than me to unpack that because it's a real psychological thing. And then there's also traits of that we can find in all of us.
True.
But I think our society does reward some behaviors that are about self-promotion. And that's a difficult one to tease out. In the culture I grew up in Australia, we have what we call tall poppy syndrome. So if you are the poppy or the flower that rises above all the others, you get cut down. That's
wow.
Like the rest of society kind of pulls together to make sure that you know you're not better than anybody else.
Wow.
So the Australian culture kind of is a little less driven that way. it would have been my perspective growing up. And I had a friend who had a fair bit of notoriety in Australia, a fair bit of publicity. And if I was out on the street with him, it sometimes felt like he would get equal parts love and equal parts abuse. Like people just walking past him, just, you know, and I don't think that's positive, by the way. But the effect is that it kind of keeps everyone, you know, grounded. And here, I think it's largely the opposite. There's a lot of praise that comes with that. And there's a lot of reward for the ways that we promote ourselves. And I don't think all of that's bad either. It creates a sense of possibility. Yeah. There's no one kind of telling you, you can't do this and you shouldn't do that. And who do you think you are to have that dream? So there's some really beautiful parts of that. But it also comes with the caution around how we discern in our own hearts where we're getting joy from and what's it leading.
Oh, the tall poppy syndrome. So that's a huge kind of new way of understanding the cultural dynamics around ego. And I talked a little bit about that in my book, where you have the different worldviews, and it really depends on your worldview. So if you're in an honor shame kind of worldview, then yeah, tall poppy syndrome is real. In my context, we call that crabs in the bucket. Where if you've ever tried to like steam or cook live crabs, they pull that, whoever's trying to get high, we pull them down. We call it the crabs in the bucket syndrome. But it really depends on your cultural context. So let's talk about the tall poppies and the crabs that God has chosen to rise out of the bucket. What guidance would you give to people who are authentically called by God to be on higher levels, on bigger spotlights, on larger stages, not by their own choosing, but by God's appointment? What would you say to them?
I think to one degree or another, we all have that responsibility. You know, even just by virtue of growing older and having younger people in your world, you carry a sense of weight and a sense of power that you need to steward. And so I think we all, to various degrees, have that. And whether it's getting up in front of 20 people, like the first time I spoke in my school, little kind of lunchtime gathering for a Bible study, there's something that comes with that. Or whether you're getting up in front of thousands, like there's a weight there. I think it's something for us to all wrestle with. And I think it's something that Jesus is addressing with all of his disciples, regardless of what their futures held. They all had to wrestle with that. Look, I think it's important that we get good at the receiving. So the way we are unmoored when we haven't got practices or capacity to receive God's love, I think causes us to then look for those needs to be met in other ways. And so we can fill that with the admiration of people.
Yes.
But there's an instinct towards that in and amongst leaders, I think, you know. Yeah. So I think you look at Peter, who is the kind of archetypal leader amongst Jesus's band of 12, and Jesus is washing the disciples' feet. He's on his knees. He's taken off his outer garment. And Peter says, "You're going to wash my feet?" And Jesus says, "You don't know what I'm doing now, but later you're going to understand." And Peter says, "You will never wash my feet."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that instinct in Peter, or that instinct in a leader to go, "No, you're not going to do anything for me. You're not going to serve me like that, Jesus. I'm going to be the one serving. I'm going to be the one doing things." I think we got to wrestle with that and come to places where we can really receive. And I think it's sometimes really difficult for the leaders. And I know it's something that's difficult for me, to engage with silence, to receive God's love, to feel loved by God, to feel the weight of his pleasure towards me, to feel him smile towards me, and to not just know that intellectually, but to feel it bodily and to be grounded in that love. That's something else. And so I think the receiving part is really important, like how we create space to receive. And then I think the giving part is part of that, like what are the spaces where we are giving and contributing to others. And Jesus, it's interesting to me that washing the disciples' feet is this picture of humility. I think to this day, there is a beautiful reflection by a pastor out of Australia named John, and he wrote a book on humility called Humilitas. And he says that in the ancient world, humility was never a virtue because it was always something that was done to you. You were humiliated. But in the modern world now, we easily identify it as a virtue that we should all aspire to. And he says Jesus is what changed that. And I think if we chose a moment in Jesus's ministry where he is giving us insight into that, that moment washing the disciples' feet would be it. And certainly he goes on to the cross, which is the ultimate expression of that. But washing his disciples' feet is so interesting because if you've ever washed someone's feet, it's just such intimate.
Absolutely.
Service.
Absolutely.
Like it's such a connected act of service.
Yeah.
And I think we need those intimate and connected acts of service. I think we can think about service and it can sometimes represent the way that we go maybe serve an organization that's serving others and we can get involved doing certain things. I think there's got to be an intimacy to our service that is really what enlivens our humanity through it. And that's what we find Jesus doing.
Yeah. And, you know, this balance between Jesus as one who models receiving through his prayer, through the affirmation that he receives from God, and then models that giving kind of suggests that there has to be an inflowing to understand who you are according to God's understanding of yourself so that you can pour out to others and help them properly understand themselves as well.
Absolutely.
I love that.
Absolutely. So the incredible thing in John 13, I think, is that before Jesus washes his disciples' feet, we have this little moment where we get an insight into his mindset. And it says that Jesus, knowing that God had given all things to him, like there was a deep knowledge within him of his power, responsibility, sonship, connection to the Father, like all of this stuff is driving and writhing within him, out of which he takes off his outer garment.
Yes.
He begins to wash the disciples' feet.
Yes.
And so it's that groundedness in who we are. And I think sometimes when we think about humility or taming the ego, we're just thinking about almost how we destroy it. But there's a healthy way of us understanding who we are that's really important. And so for us to just think of ourselves as worms that are worthless doesn't produce the bedrock from which we are called to serve and love and lead other people. And we've got to engage with it, I think, in some different ways to that.
Oh my goodness. And you talked about a way to engage with that is to return to contemplative practices, which I don't think is very popular in American society, mostly because of our pace of life and because, you know, we think of that as like new agey, you know, to have a contemplative practice. But what does that look like for you? Like, what's it look like in your own life?
Well, look, to be fair, I think partly what makes it difficult in today's culture is that I think depending on levels of trauma at play in your body, sometimes silence is really hard. And so I think we've got to have a bit of grace for ourselves and for others, because sometimes what our body is needing and what we're physically able to engage with, it can be more or less difficult depending on what's going on internally. But I think it's really, really important. Pete Jerry Scazzero, he did a lot of work around emotionally healthy spirituality.
Right.
And his coursework, so his books are phenomenal. But I think when we got here, we had a chance to get involved with some of that coursework. And so a huge part of that is silence.
Yes. And
really sitting in places where we allow ourselves to be filled with God's love for us. And I think a lot of meditative practices are about emptying ourselves. And there's a value there. But I think in Christian meditative practices, it's not just about the emptying, it's about being filled. And so for me, it's sitting in moments where I can be filled with and allow myself to feel God's love. And it actually takes time to engage like that. And so for me, it'll be trying to be still. And I like to either focus on my breath. And I think that's meaningful for me because that word for spirit in both the Hebrew and the Greek is that word for breath. So it connects to how God breathes his life to us and then continues to breathe his life into us. So I think breath is really important to me, and even thinking about breath work and how we breathe. And I think most of us breathe really shallowly, and we breathe into kind of our chests up here, but we ignore our diaphragms and we ignore kind of the fullness of the breath that we can have. And I know it sounds kind of really physical and basic, but I think, like, for me, it's engaging with God in spaces where I can breathe deeply. Sometimes focusing in on the end of my nostril, as Pete talks about in a lot of his work, and the breath coming in and out. And then also to be thinking about, for me, a picture of Jesus smiling towards me is just, to this day, I still find it, you know, challenging, and it takes a little while to kind of melt into that place of being able to receive it. But yeah, that those are probably my two kind of favorite ways to engage like that.
So how does your understanding of yourself, your ego, and, you know, how you use this contemplative practice to make sure that there's balance between the discipline and the delight, how does that affect how you lead your teams?
I think for me, it's a lot of it has to do with paying attention to my body, like what's going on internally. That's something probably relatively new for me. I think it's never something I've paused to consider before. But if I look back on my leadership, there would have been many times when my body was trying to tell me, hey, you're not sitting in your regulated window, able to respond well and be kind of a non-anxious presence. Like you're just reacting out of something from the past. And so I think in recent times, like becoming more aware of what's going on for me physically, understanding that, oh, hang on, that pain there, that's an indication that I'm starting to get riled up about something, or I'm starting to be reactive towards something. So I need to take a moment. I need to breathe deeply, acknowledge whatever that thing is that's causing me to feel that way. And look, I grew up, I mean, there were no men in my life that kind of modeled or exampled emotionally anything other than you'd see anger, or you'd see sometimes joy, or the kind of frivolous kind of expression of that. And that was kind of it. So like when I come into environments where I've and engaged with the very basics of kind of emotional awareness, I didn't even have a language to express what was going on within me. I'd sit there and do these exercises where you had to kind of search what's going on internally and say, well, I'm feeling this, or I'm feeling this. And you had to use the emotion words. Like I got to turn to the appendix and the page of all the different emotions. What are my options here?
You need a feelings wheel.
I remember sitting in a big Zoom. There's a couple hundred pastors, I think, going through the emotionally healthy relationships course. And there was a pastor from Harlem. And he got up and just started talking in a conversation with his wife. They were doing an incarnational listening exercise, and he starts expressing the different emotions that are going on within him. And he talked about the sadness he was feeling about something. He talked about the guilt he was feeling about something. I mean, he's in tears. I'm in tears. Probably everyone watching is in tears. But it was the first time I can remember seeing a man start to give expression to what's going on within. And so that's been huge for me as a journey, to start to be able to articulate what's going on internally, be able to give expression. And for me, that's been really significant. So if I'm coming into team environments and I'm noticing things in my body, then I can acknowledge kind of what's causing that. I can put a hand on my chest, tell myself to, it's all right, come, you know, like just come to a place where you can endeavor to be a non-anxious presence.
Yes.
So that and lots of apologizing at different times for when I get it wrong.
Oh my goodness. You know, I had a pastor when I was in seminary, I had a pastor tell a group of seminarians that a pastor ought never apologize because it's a sign of weakness, that a pastor should never apologize.
Yes. Well, I'm a weak pastor.
Oh my goodness. Listen, that's the power of the Holy Spirit.
And a weak husband, so, and a weak friend. I'm just weak.
I'm just weak. Call me weak. Oh, but it does sound like part of the way that we can lead teams well is by being in tune with who God has called us to be, and with what's happening in our bodies, and with what's happening in our spirits. Because I assume, but I've also experienced for myself, when a leader leads like that, you give permission for other people to do the same. I mean, you're the type of person we want in a conflict situation, because you will be able to give room to people to pause and to process what's really happening within you. Have you found that to be useful in situations of conflict?
Yeah, I found it to be useful for me personally to pause and reflect. But then I've also had people around me that call me out on it, you know, that tell me, hey, you're being defensive. And I think that's a difficult road to walk, because you want a healthy kind of expression of honor in a culture, but you also want to have an environment where people are going to be able to call you out when they see things. And sometimes that's going to feel unfair and maybe even be unfair, and they're going to be wrong. And sometimes it's going to be right and they're going to be spot on. But that's just people, and that's just interactions. And so, you know, once again, being regulated enough to hear the things that are unfair as well as the things that are fair, and to respond kindly. I think that stuff's really, really difficult. Yeah. Honestly, it's much easier for me to talk about than it is for me to do it.
Of course it is.
You know.
But you know, again, going back to what you said about making space in your life to receive an accurate view of who you are in God's eyes makes it possible to then receive critique and not be defensive, because you know, A, there might be some merit to what people are saying, and then B, my personhood doesn't rest in that person's opinion. Who I am rests in what God says. And that is just, that's one of the major nuggets I'm taking away from this conversation, that as we make room for understanding who we are from God's view and make Him, His pleasure, His delight in us, the highlight of who we are, it just makes us better able to lead people to do the same.
Yeah. It's being differentiated, you know, in the midst of everything else that's going on. Steve Cust talks about differentiation, and I love, he kind of uses this example of being in a hospital room and responding to a situation where someone had died. He's a chaplain. He's trying to get around to all the family. And then there's a nurse telling him, we need to clear out this room. You need to get that family in there. And so he's bouncing around, responding to all of the anxieties in everyone and responding to those instead of pausing to go, actually, hang on, what's needed in this situation?
Yeah.
And I think as leaders, you can get reactive like that, especially in an anxiety-ridden environment or culture, where you're just bouncing around trying to meet people's anxieties, and you lose that sense of differentiation. And Steve Cust suggests that you can lose differentiation by either becoming enmeshed or completely disconnected. And both of those are unhelpful. And usually we have a tendency to one or the other, either to be enmeshed. So whatever everybody else is feeling or somebody else we're meeting with is feeling, I'm feeling all of those things. I just take it all on. Or you tell me anything you want and it doesn't touch me at all. I have no emotional response or engagement. So you want to strike that kind of magic, beautiful, healthy in between. And I think it's impossible to do 100% all the time well. But I think we can kind of become aware of it, hopefully grow in it.
Oh, my goodness. You have just blessed and encouraged and challenged us with some great perspectives today. So what is, you know, as you think about what we've been talking about with ego and how leaders show up for themselves, for God, what's one final word that you want to leave? And maybe you can imagine there are leaders listening who are trying to figure out how they get into the contemplative practices. Maybe there are leaders listening who are trying to feel a better way of showing up, or maybe there are leaders who are engaged in the trappings of, you know, being the tall poppy in their communities. What are some words of encouragement, or just, you know, whatever words you want to share with those listeners?
Look, the Emotionally Healthy Relationship course, I think, is a great starting point. And the actual coursework, because then you're doing the work and you're practicing the practices, which then helps you kind of start to embody this stuff and not just know it intellectually. But I'd encourage people towards joy. I think we started on this idea of there is a delight, there is a sense of God's pleasure in doing what He's called us to do. And I think as leaders, we can sometimes ignore the delight to come back to some of that joy, and particularly as church leaders. And I didn't have any huge understandings of Sabbath until the last few years. And as I continue to grow and wrestle with that, one aspect of Sabbath isn't just ceasing from work, but it's engaging in delight. So what are the environments where we're engaging with delight, and what does that joy look like in our lives? And I think particularly as Christian leaders, that joy is something that is called to be present for our own souls, but also for the cultures and the environments that we're leading. Father Alexander Schmemann has this beautiful quote. I'm not going to remember it exactly, but he basically says, from its very beginning, Christianity was the proclamation of joy. And it lost the world when it lost the joy and ceased to be a credible witness to it.
Wow.
And so I think as leaders, if we can engage in delight and joy, it starts to shift everything.
Yes.
And that's what I'm hoping for personally.
Yes.
That's what we're working on. And it's what my hope would be for leaders that are kind of listening in.
Awesome.
Leaning into this conversation.
Joy and delight. I mean, what better words of faith are there? That is amazing. How can people keep up with you?
I don't know. We run a church in New York City. We're here on Sun, you know, we have services on Sundays. We have a YouTube channel where all the messages go up. So that's probably the easiest way. And then our church has a kind of Instagram account and that kind of thing. So all of that's possible. But, you know, I'm still figuring out what to do with it. Some of this that you're talking about is
current
real-time wrestle. So.
Oh, well, you have blessed us by your willingness to wrestle publicly with us. You have touched on so many things that I will be thinking about long after this conversation. So thank you so much, Pastor Krishan, for joining us today. You are a blessing.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been a joy to be with you.
Awesome. All right, listeners, we'll see you next week. The Disruptors is a production of InterVarsity Press. For more information on any IVP titles mentioned in this episode, visit ivpress.com and use code IVPOD25. That's IVPOD25 for 25% off. Sound engineering by Honest Podcasts. Our producers are Jack Reese, Helen Lee, and Travis Albritton. Our production assistant is Christine Felicio Mello. And I'm your host, Nicole Massey Martin. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the IVP YouTube channel, and leave a rating and review to support the podcast.